This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal thought capsule in which inside 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, why are drug deaths in Scotland so much higher than in the rest of the UK? The latest figures for drugs deaths in Scotland came out last week and they were terrible. In fact, they've been terrible for some time. They're tragic in themselves, of course, but understanding why they're so bad is to get to grips with the ways in which people, policies, and public health interact, not just in Scotland, but anywhere. So, why do so many Scots die from drugs? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's have a summary of the latest data. Joining me in the briefing room is the BBC's Scotland editor, James Cook. James Cook, the latest figures on drug deaths in Scotland were released last week. What did they say?
Well, to be blunt, David, they confirm that Scotland is in the grip of a national emergency, a really serious crisis. 1,330 people died of drug misuse in Scotland in 2021. And that number, which had been actually rising for years, since 1996, it's been going up and up and up. It actually has fallen slightly compared to the previous year, compared to 2020. It's down by 9 deaths. But that still leaves it by far the highest level in the UK. It is 4.8 times the death rate from drug misuse that England sees. And National Records of Scotland statisticians say that the data across Great Britain are collected in a similar way, and you can make these comparisons. It's trickier to draw quite as precise a comparison with the rest of Europe because of differences, as you might expect, in the precise way that data are collected. But we do know enough to say that Scotland is far worse than anywhere else in Europe.
Now, I imagine there's significant variation between different parts of Scotland. So where is there a particular problem?
The areas that are worst affected are the cities of Dundee and Glasgow, and also the area to the northwest of Glasgow along the River Clyde, known as Inverclyde, a post-industrial area that has struggled with poverty. I spent a bit of time in Dundee talking to some drug workers there. Charity workers say they're considering opening a women-only centre offering advice in Dundee, because they say they have seen an increase in the number of women who are dying there, and that women are not necessarily as keen as men to come to some of these facilities that might be shared for various reasons. They might have experienced abuse. They might have had other traumatic events in their background that means they don't want to be in a space with men. So that's something they're looking at there to try to improve things. But if you look at that figure overall, the number of women dying actually rose by 31 in the year to 2020. The number of men dying dropped by 40. But David, I think it's quite important not to read at this stage too much into that, because there are still far more male deaths than female deaths. And there is not enough evidence yet, I think, to be sure that either of these things are a trend, or indeed, if you look at the overall picture, to say that the drug deaths in Scotland have definitely stabilised or are coming down. This might be a blip on a continuing upwards trajectory. We'll need more years of data to be sure.
Just how big an impact do these figures have on Scottish society and Scottish discussion?
Well, it's a good question because, you know, day to day, the issues that dominate Scottish political debate are similar to the issues that dominate debate across the UK in terms of people struggling with the cost of living crisis. But this is very much a part of the national debate. And particularly when the figures are published, one campaigner described it to me as a massive failure of government. Clearly, the Scottish government would say that they are trying to make things better. But the discrepancy between Scotland and England is so dramatic that has fueled a really heated and contentious debate about who is failing whom here and what is going wrong. And I'll be totally honest with you, with figures this high, it's pretty clear that no one has yet got a grip on it.
James Cook. So that's the what. Now to the why. Why is Scotland different? I'm joined in the briefing room by Andrew McCauley, a consultant healthcare scientist at NHS Public Health Scotland, and Kirsten Horsburgh, Director of Operations at the Scottish Drugs Forum. Kirsten, we've just heard that deaths are overwhelmingly located in deprived areas. Can you just expand on why you think that is?
Yeah, that's correct. And what we saw from last year is that you were 15 times more likely to die from a drug-related death if you were in one of the areas with the highest deprivation. And with poverty and deprivation comes a lack of opportunity and health inequalities. And we know that physical health problems are key contributing factors to drug deaths, such as breathing problems, like heart-related conditions and liver problems. And people experiencing drug problems are often also experiencing mental health problems too, which is usually driven by unimaginable trauma, childhood abuse, violence, bereavements. I mean, the list goes on.
That's very interesting. So one of the things that you're saying is that people are more likely to die from drug-related problems if they are actually unhealthy already, and many of these people are already unhealthy.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when people are dying from an overdose, they are dying from an overdose because they can't breathe. So if you've already got pre-existing breathing problems, then that certainly increases your risk of dying.
Andrew, I take it you broadly agree with that.
Obviously, poverty is one of the strongest drivers of problematic drug use. But certainly, there's more than just poverty. If you compare Scotland against comparably deprived areas in England, the Scottish rates are still much higher. So there's obviously more at play than poverty and inequality here.
Kirsten.
What I would also add is that although we've talked about poverty, deprivation and all the other areas that can affect and be drivers for problem drug use, on top of all of that, we also then criminalise people for dealing with the issues that they're facing. And as if that wasn't enough, we have a notion that drug problems are somehow a lifestyle choice, so code for they deserve what they get. So stigma plays a huge role in all of this as well, from people accessing care and treatment to the way that they feel about themselves. And that leads to hopelessness and a complete lack of self-worth, and can often result in the ambivalence often, where people don't necessarily want to die, but are not that fussed about living either.
Now, I want to come to how treatment might vary between Scotland and England in a moment. But Andrew, what drugs are the people who are dying actually taking?
This is one of the things we've seen quite a shift in the last decade. Typically, at the moment, the main drugs contributing to drug-related deaths are opioids, so drugs like heroin and methadone. But it's very unusual for people to die of a drug-related death with just one drug involved. And typically, the poly-drug combination, so people taking more than one substance at one time, the poly-drug combination typically involves these opioids and benzodiazepines, such as diazepam, more commonly known as Valium. Around 10 years ago, the benzodiazepines that people were largely taking at that time were diverted prescriptions, which were prescribed to an individual, but making their way onto the street market. But what we did observe around that time was a tightening of that prescribing route from the prescribers themselves. And that caused a kind of curtailing of the supply on the streets, and that supply on the streets has largely been replaced by what we refer to as street benzodiazepines, so imported drugs that are not made in what we would call professional laboratories, more amateur laboratories that lack the quality control of what these drugs people have been taking in the past. And that's led people into much more riskier environments where they don't know what they're taking from session to session.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because what it suggests is that a policy undertaken in good faith, in other words, we shouldn't overprescribe benzodiazepines, becomes translated into, well, in that case, I'll get my drug and I'll get my high some other way, and the other way is more dangerous.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the people who designed that policy at the time had good intentions, but the unintended consequences of that policy probably weren't fully thought through.
Now, Kirsten, when we had, and we still got, the opioid crisis in the United States, there was a lot of talk about how emergencies are dealt with once you know they're happening. What's being done in Scotland to stop overdoses or poisonings becoming fatal?
Sure. So the first priority for us is to keep people alive. And treatment can prevent overdoses happening in the first place. But once an overdose has occurred, it's essential that we know how to recognise that it's an overdose. So being aware of the signs and symptoms, and to also have the medication naloxone available. And naloxone is the medication that reverses the effects of opioids that Andy described. So 84% of our deaths involve opioids. So that emergency response is sadly what we need more of at the minute, because we have such a scale of the number of people overdosing every day.
Can you just remind us what naloxone is?
Sure. It's a medication that if a person has been using opioids, naloxone kicks the opioids off the receptors and enables the person to breathe temporarily until emergency support arrives.
So it's a little bit like a kind of snake bite antidote serum or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. I mentioned earlier that we want to talk a little bit about treatment for addicts, how that compares between Scotland and England, Kirsten.
Yeah, so if people that were experiencing drug problems were getting enough help, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. So we have up to 60,000 people experiencing drug problems in Scotland, and less than 40% actually accessing the treatment that could potentially save and change their life. So people need rapid access to high quality, optimal and equitable treatment across the country. We have a thing in Scotland called medication-assisted treatment standards, which have just been introduced over the last year. Or launched over the last year. And these require to be adopted nationally, delivered quickly and adequately resourced. And what that would mean for people would be that rather than waiting weeks and weeks and months for life-saving treatment, people would be able to access things like prescriptions on the day that they present to services. They would have a choice as to what that treatment is. And they would also be given lots of other wraparound interventions to support them to stay in that treatment for as long as they wanted. So we definitely need to improve our treatment, and treatment saves lives.
And that treatment is currently more available in England, is it, than it is in Scotland?
There's certainly more people experiencing drug problems accessing treatment in England than there is in Scotland.
Now, Andrew, I want to go back to something you touched on earlier. Is part of the problem also that there are proportionately more drug users in Scotland per head of the population than there are in England and other parts of the United Kingdom? And if so, why do we think that is?
Yeah, that is part of the problem. Basic demographics are at play here. We do have, per head of population, we do have more what we would crudely call problematic drug users than in other countries in the UK, but also other comparatively sized countries in Europe, particularly the Scandinavian countries, for example. So by definition, if you have lots of people using drugs problematically, then you're potentially lots of people who could die a drug-related death. If you think about a lot of people at the edge of the cliff, at the moment Scotland has much more people at the edge of the cliff than other countries do. And that is a legacy of a kind of long period of problematic drug use stemming from the late 70s into the early 80s. So we have individuals who have been using drugs over that 30 or 40 year period. The size of that group hasn't shrunk in any way over the last 10 to 15 years. It's generally around the 60,000 mark, despite all the mortality we've had. So we do have that sizable chunk there compared to other countries.
Kirsten, that's really interesting because it also suggests the possibility of multi-generational drug use habituation. In other words, frankly, kids see their parents doing it.
Yeah, and what we need to also remember is that when we talked about trauma earlier and trauma in early years that people might experience, a lot of the trauma for young people is that their parents die from a drug-related death. So a huge number of people who died last year and have died every year for a number of years around this will have been parents. And we can't underestimate that generational impact that this crisis continues to impose.
From what I can see, and correct me if I'm wrong, alcohol-related deaths follow a not dissimilar pattern. In other words, they're significantly higher in Scotland than they are in, say, England. What does the combination of drug deaths and alcohol-related deaths suggest as an underlying factor?
Yeah, so I think the point you're getting at is what's been crudely termed the deaths of despair. So Scotland is disproportionately more likely to experience a higher rate of deaths of despair. And what we call the deaths of despair are deaths related to drugs, deaths related to alcohol, and deaths related to suicide. So there's a fairly extensive body of research, particularly colleagues at the Glasgow Centre for Population Health have been leading on this, which really highlights that Scotland does suffer much more poorly related to these mortality trends than in other parts of the UK. And again, I would reflect back to other parts of the UK with similar levels of deprivation. Now, there's no single explanation why Scotland fares worse than these other countries. It's a kind of complex interplay of factors related to things like Kirsten's mentioned in terms of poverty, inequality, childhood trauma, etc. But Scotland definitely stands as an outlier in these deaths. One thing I would add, though, is the trends are not the same. The drug-related death trend has largely been one that's increased consistently since around 1996. But if you look at trends, for example, in alcohol-related deaths, and whether you look at alcohol-specific deaths or alcohol-attributable deaths, there's different ways to look at it. But alcohol-related deaths have had periods where they have stabilised, albeit they've began to increase in recent years. And the approach towards something like alcohol in Scotland from a policy perspective has been much more prioritised in recent years than drug-related deaths has. It's only in the last couple of years that we've seen drug-related deaths go to the top of the kind of policy priority list. Alcohol policy has been a priority for a long period of time, if you think about kind of bold, innovative policies like minimum unit pricing, for example.
Andrew McCauley there and Kirsten Horsburgh. Those, then, are the problems, and pretty complex they are. So what solutions might there be? Joining me now is Professor Katrina Matheson of the University of Stirling. She used to lead Scotland's Drug Deaths Task Force. And also with me is Professor Alex Stevens of the University of Kent. He studies drug policies around the world and has looked extensively at Scotland. Katrina Matheson, how would you characterise current Scottish Government strategy on the drugs problem?
What we have is a mission statement to reduce drug-related deaths. What is still missing is a strategy and a delivery plan to go with that. Now, hopefully, the work of the task force is going to inform that.
I want to get a little bit more into the question of the Scottish Drug Death Task Force in a moment. But in general terms, would you say the Scottish Government sees this as a public health problem now rather than, you know, typical tabloid merchants of death must be pursued kind of approach?
Yes, and this is where the Scottish Government have done very well. You know, they have adopted a public health approach, which is very welcome, and that's where there is difference between Scotland and England in terms of strategy and general approach. So a public health approach really recognises people will take drugs and can come to harm, and we should try to reduce that harm and try to get people into some form of care or treatment. And in doing so, you know, try to minimise contact with that criminal justice service, which itself is very harmful to people.
You resigned from the Scottish Drug Deaths Task Force a few months ago before it actually issued its report, which was last week. Why was that?
Well, when I started, the remit was to be challenging and we had some independence. But that was eroded over time. And ultimately, I wasn't convinced any longer of the commitment to really deliver an evidence-based plan and approach.
Alex Stevens, you've been keeping a very close eye on all this. What's your assessment of the Scottish Government approach, and what do you think is most clearly missing from it?
The Scottish Government have moved a lot quicker and a lot further than the UK Government towards an appropriate response to a public health emergency of drug-related deaths, which is taking place across the UK, but most acutely in Scotland. I think, as Katrina said, what's missing is a detailed plan of how that's actually going to happen.
So what would you have in that detailed plan that therefore is not there at the moment?
We would want to see a comprehensive treatment system in the context of a comprehensive approach to reducing the problems that produce problematic drug use in Scotland. So we've got an immediate crisis of people who are already using heroin and various other substances, but there's a longer term problem of what is it about the Scottish economy, Scottish society, that keeps producing these public health problems of not only drug-related deaths, but of alcohol and obesity-related deaths.
OK, so there's an overall huge public health problem which goes well beyond drug use. If we limit ourselves for the moment to what could be done to limit drug deaths and so on, what might usefully be in a plan like that that isn't already or that might be increased?
Well, that's been laid out by reports from both the Scottish Affairs Committee and the Health and Social Care Committee of the House of Commons. The elements of that that are missing in current UK and Scottish policy are things like decriminalising drug use and drug possession and providing enhanced harm reduction services, including overdose prevention centres. Now, neither of these are silver bullets that will magically wave away the public health crisis of drug-related deaths, but they're elements of a comprehensive harm reduction-focused, evidence-based approach to reducing these deaths.
Katrina, can we be clear about this? Is what we're saying here that there are certain facilities which could be offered if we were to decriminalise possession that can't easily be offered if we don't? And if so, what are they?
There's that one specific initiative that is affected by the decriminalisation issue and the control by the Misuse of Drugs Act, and that is these supervised safe consumption centres. But there is a bigger issue here. These safe consumption sites have been proved to be effective, particularly in places like Vancouver, where there was a huge drug death crisis, and they really helped get that under control, but not in isolation. And that's what's really crucial. There's other aspects that must be part of the system, where we have overdose response teams who can quickly intervene when people have a non-fatal overdose, where we also have in stabilisation units, which are residential kind of clinical facilities for those very high risk people who really need a place of safety to get their drug use rapidly under some form of medical control. So these are all part of that package that needs to be delivered to move forward.
Alex, I want to make sure that I've understood this properly. You can have these safe consumption places. They would have the effect, obviously, if people would be able to consume drugs safely there as opposed to unsafely. And presumably, they'd also have the impact of those using them would come into contact with the drug services rather than just doing what they're doing outside. Is it your view that they could have any kind of significant effect? And is it your view, like Katrina's, that would only be a small part of things? And is it your view, and I'm summarising here, also, that actually there's a temptation to look at this as being a potential quick win without which you can't make progress, and therefore it serves a kind of political purpose?
There are obviously political debates around this, and it has become almost a symbolic issue, which I think is regrettable, because there are real gains to be made here. We did some research with a volunteer activist called Peter Krykant, who ran an unsanctioned overdose prevention site in Glasgow in 2021. And there weren't any deaths in the facility where people were injecting substances because there were people there who could intervene if there was an overdose. More than that, they could provide information and advice about injecting technique. They could prevent overdoses happening in the first place. And more than that, they could talk to those people about the wide range of problems they're experiencing. It's not just about people's drug use. It's about their welfare, their health, their disability. The centre in Glasgow, for example, dealt with somebody who for months had been going around on a wheelchair with only three wheels. There were people there who didn't have enough to eat. You know, this is a very low threshold service, which opens the door to the wider range of support that people need.
Right. Now, has decriminalisation of the sort that would be necessary to have this done on a wide scale been tried elsewhere in Europe, and does it work?
I suppose the most famous these days is Portugal, which decriminalised the possession of all drugs, not just cannabis, for personal use in 2001, followed by a substantial fall in both drug-related deaths and drug-related HIV infections. But it's important to remember that Portugal and other places that have had these public health benefits have done so not only by decriminalising possession of drugs, but also by introducing the wider package of public health measures, prime among them expanding access to effective drug treatment, by which the most effective service is opioid agonist therapy. So providing things like methadone and buprenorphine and heroin itself on prescription so that people can move away from the dangers of the street market.
Katrina, I imagine that drug criminality is a UK piece of legislation. Does the Scottish Government say that it should be changed?
Yes, the view is that the Misuse of Drugs Act, which is now 50 years old, is no longer really fit for purpose in relation to this particular aspect of the control of drugs and the criminalisation of people who are found in possession, for example.
And what do we understand the UK government's response to that to be?
They've rejected this. It was a recommendation from the Scottish Affairs Committee that looked at problem drug use in Scotland back in 2019. And they had a number of recommendations about this, which were rejected in the response from the UK government.
Alex, are there other initiatives which Scotland, despite this, could copy?
It's interesting that the Scottish Drugs Death Task Force recommends something that has been done in England that some people see as having had an effect, which is to make the drug treatment system more transparent and more accountable. And I'd be interested in Katrina's views on this, because the Scottish Drugs Death Task Force has recommended, for example, that there be a national outcomes framework in Scotland, like there is in England, and that there should be more system integration and more accountability towards achieving those outcomes, which in England, for example, a target has been set to reduce the levels of drug-related deaths by 1,000.
Katrina.
I'm a bit unsure about the specific target setting. I think reducing by a percentage is something that would be certainly welcomed, having a form of target of that sort. But when you get into targets, it becomes very difficult unless you know that you've got the funding that is required to deliver those targets.
So, Katrina, is funding a problem?
Yes, funding is a problem. And in Scotland, funding was cut by Scottish Government in 2017, just at the point that drug deaths were already on an upward trajectory, unfortunately. That funding has been reinstated, but the level of investment needed really needs to be increased considerably further.
I want to ask one final question. We heard earlier when we were talking to Kirsten Horsburgh and Andrew McCauley about what are called the deaths of despair in Scotland, which include a whole range of public health problems. Can you tell me whether you think that these combination of problems actually means that a country like Scotland needs to spend a lot more and put a lot more emphasis on its overall public health problem than other countries might do?
Yes, is the answer. Real investment in reducing inequalities in health, investing in communities at community level and supporting people to facilitate the changes that they might want to do. It's crucial. Yep.
Alex.
I think this echoes what senior NHS leaders have been saying for a long time, which is that we need to shift the focus from dealing with the problems we cause by creating high levels of poverty and inequality to thinking about how we prevent those problems. Now, that is something that is outside the control of drug treatment services. It's even outside the control of senior NHS leaders. This is a national challenge, I mean, across the UK, and particularly acute in Scotland. I gave the example of Portugal earlier. People often forget that at the same time as Portugal decriminalised drugs in 2001, the socialist government introduced a guaranteed minimum income and a programme of decent social housing. And we're not going to solve these deeply entrenched public health problems unless we stop the social determinants of these public health problems.
Alex Stevens there with Katrina Matheson. My thanks to them and to James Cook, Andrew McCauley and Kirsten Horsburgh. We'll be back next week. The Briefing was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Kirsty Knight, Tim Mansell and Simon Watts. The studio manager was Rod Parker and the editor was Richard Barden. If you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune into the one about whether the dispute over Taiwan is a threat to world peace. And there's also an edition about the new variants of the COVID virus. How worried should we be?
Hello, I'm Lucy Worsley, and I want to tell you about Lady Killers. It's a new series from BBC Radio 4. It's a programme that mixes true crime with history, but with a twist. With our all-female team of experts, I am re-examining the crimes of Victorian murderesses through the eyes of 21st century feminists. What can we learn from these women, and would it be any different today? Listen to Lady Killers on BBC Sounds.
Der Kick der Woche mit warmen Looks für kalte Tage.
So viel mehr Wohlfühlmode.
Mit Damenhausslipper, je 5,99 Euro.
Und so viel mehr für die Piste.
Mit Kinder-Skijacken oder Hosen ab 12,99 Euro. Nur jetzt und nur bei Kick. Mehr als du denkst.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.